Scripture reading tonight will be coming from the book of Jonah, the second chapter, Jonah chapter 2, beginning in verse 7. We'll be reading from the King James Version. Jonah 2, beginning in verse 7. When my soul fainted within me, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came in unto thee, into thine holy temple. They that observe lying vanities forsake their own mercy. But I will sacrifice unto thee with the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay that I have vowed. Salvation is of the Lord.
Good evening. It's been good to be with you all on this Lord's Day. It's been really good to eat with you all on this Lord's Day. This Sunday we have been talking about some of the kinds of sacrifices that were made under the old law, and looking at how that kind of thing should be involved in the spiritual sacrifices that we offer to the Lord in our spirits today. So we've talked so far about first fruits offerings. We talked this morning about burnt offerings. Tonight, I want to take a look at fellowship or peace offerings. By show of hands, who here remembers when you used to go to town to the drugstore or the general store for a soda pop or ice cream or candy? I just got you started. I got to take my hand down. Leave them up. All right, now, who here remembers when that trip was the only time that you got soda pop, ice cream, or candy all week long? All right. How times have changed, huh? You know, where there used to be that one counter, in any given store now, there are at least four or five aisles dedicated to that kind of treat. And those kind of things are now daily indulgences. In my own home, we have one or two punch bowls full of candy that get refilled at every passing holiday. Major or minor, I come in. What are these Reese's about? Arbor Day. Okay, all right. Every visit from Nana, every time that the dad goes to store without wife supervision and is hungry, you know, we pack up on the briars. All these treats, all the time, kind of take the specialness out of the holidays, don't they? Think about just the uniquely American days. 4th of July, Thanksgiving. What do? Overeat and watch TV. But don't we do that every day? Well, you know, what's the problem with that? What are you, a commie? Get out of here. You know, that's kind of the attitude we have. We enjoy these things. In times of abundance, these rare treats, when they're not so rare, are less accounted. Now, here's another sign of the times. I live with the daily assumption that every meal will have at least the option of some kind of meat included. I've had times where my wife will call me and say, I'm making a soup and we don't really have meat for dinner. Is that okay? Because I guess she knew and I grew up and we'd always have meat at the table. But from that particular disposition, that kind of assumption, we might miss something that an Israelite would have very much appreciated about the peace offering. It presented the rare treat of meat for dinner. The average family ate meat only on festive occasions. The more common meat would have been like hunted game. But you hunters know that you can't expect meat in the pot after every time that you go out, right? And as for the flocks and as for the herds, an animal as stock was too expensive an asset just for you to kill one every week for victuals. So there's this old Western song about a cowpoke trying to make it to his next payday. And it goes, I ain't got a dime in these old worn out jeans, so I'll stop eating steak and I'll go back to beans. Or there's that proverb that says in Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 17, a bowl of vegetables with someone you love is better than steak with someone you hate. I love how that's worded. Meat is expensive. I got acquainted with a farming family who raised Highland cattle and sheep and pigs and chickens in the old manner. I met them back when they were in Memphis. These were people who decided to become farmers. And they moved to Middle Tennessee, around Lawrenceburg, and they are doing everything free range, grass-fed, no hormones, the whole deal. And they sell to markets, local markets in Memphis and in Nashville. And from time to time, I would go and I would pick up chickens from them. And I say time to time because the chickens ran about $15 to $20 a piece. Now, the way everybody used to do it, which is what these folks are really trying to do, was time-consuming. It was labor-intensive. And that's in the time when meat was expensive. Now, if theirs was the only meat that I could get my hands on, a number of times as I was enjoying their tasteful birds, I thought, well, we would only eat meat on more special occasions. Sunday supper. That's the way it was in the ancient world. Notice, Jesus said, give us this day our daily, not steak, our daily bread. That reflects the common daily experience of people in his time. You remember when David, he sent Jesse to take food to his brothers in 1 Samuel chapter 17? What was for lunch? Take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves. They were not going Atkins. The Israelite diet consisted mainly of grains, vegetables, fruits, and condiments like oil and vinegar. The chief crops that were in biblical times were wheat, and barley, and olives, and grapes. And they ate grain parched or raw, mostly in the form of bread or a porridge that was kind of like cream of wheat. They ate a lot of lentils. They had fava beans. They had chickpeas. Their vegetables were cucumbers, watermelons, onions, leeks, garlic. That's good eating. It's not carnivorous eating. Their principal fruits were olives and grapes, date palms, pomegranates, and figs. Now, of course, there were good times and there were bad times. There were lean times and there were times of plenty. But on average, the people of the Bible, the people that the Bible was first written for, ate a pretty meager breakfast consisting of just bread and fruit. The midday meal was something you stopped work for a bit. It was composed of bread and grain and olives and figs. It was the thing that the women got up at dawn to make, and then they started right on dinner after the men left. Ruth's noon meal, for example, was made up of bread that was dipped into a vinegar-based wine along with some parched grain. Ruth chapter 2, verse 14. The main meal was eaten in the evening after sunset. That was the big meal. It followed the day's work, and the whole family participated. And the meal was basically kind of, we would think about it almost like fondue. They all sat around a one-pot stew that was served in a common bowl, and they would sop it up with bread. It was a thick porridge or a stew of vegetables, and sometimes it contained meat, sometimes it didn't. Again, if Dad came home with a good hunt, he'd throw it in the pot. But usually it was made with lentils, other vegetables, and the pottage was seasoned with herbs. Like in the deception of Esau, when Jacob was after the birthright, he prepared a lentil stew, which Esau called that red stuff. You remember that group of prophets that nearly poisoned themselves and Elisha came and he cleansed the pot? They were trying to make a very similar stew to that. You only had meat on special occasions or when you had a special guest as an extension of that exceptional hospitality that you oddly only see in cultures where the people never eat that way, where they're barely getting by from hand to mouth. When Abraham and Sarah entertained the three heavenly strangers, what did he do? He killed a calf. He served meat. Remember in the parable of the son, the prodigal son, how upset that older brother was when the father slaughtered the stall-fed calf, the fattened calf for the prodigal. His response was, he gets meat? And he's upset because basically this son who had cut so much into the family farm was being treated like an honored guest, was being treated the way Abraham treated those three angels. In the sacrificial system, there were three categories of offering that you moved through in drawing near to God, in making atonement. First, there was the atonement for sin. There was the guilt and the sin offering. Then the total consecration of yourself, and we talked about that this morning with the burnt offerings and cereal offerings and drink offerings. And only when these conditions were met could the offerer then express his continued devotion by piling on more burnt offerings and also taking part in fellowship offerings or peace offerings. So this is how God was approached. Why would you bring a peace offering? There were three separate types of fellowship offerings. You'd make a thanksgiving offering. This would be because you're grateful for a particular blessing that you had experienced. You got some sort of a bonus in your work. Someone's getting married. Someone's having a baby. Votive offerings, when you made a vow to God for whatever reason on any occasion. Free will offerings were also when you just presented it as a general expression. I'm just grateful to God. Procedurally, it was carried out a lot the same as the other types of sacrifice. And we're going to move through this pretty quick. You can find this, for the most part, in Leviticus chapter 3. The restrictions were a little bit looser. It had to be a lamb without blemish. You're still going up. You're still worshiping at the altar. But it could be a male or it could be a female. And in fact, if it was a free will offering, again, that was just the one where, hey, I want to do it. I want to do this. Well, the animal could walk with a limp. If it had one leg that was too long or too short, that was acceptable as a free will offering. The offerer brought the animal and he laid his hand on its head, that transfer of self to animal. He killed the animal at the door of the sanctuary, just like the other sacrifices. He handed it off to the priest, who would then manipulate the blood on the altar, just as the others. The priest cleaned the animal. He offered the fat and the fatty entrails on the fire of the altar. But specifically, when it came to this offering, he took that fatty material and he threw it on top of the burnt offering. Because again, you had to do that first. You already had the animal on the fire. That had to come first. But think about that for a second. What happens when fat hits the fire? When you're grilling and some of it falls down onto the flames, first of all, the flames kick up and it smells great. There is some symbolic value in that. The peace offering gave life and flavor to the burnt offering that was on the sacrifice, that was on the altar. Now next, the priest removed the breast and the right shoulder portions. Those were the priest's due. But first of all, he would heave it. It was a heave or a wave offering. He would hold the meat over the smoke of the fire, offering it to God. And in the process, there was a transfer. Then God gave it to the priest. You gave it to the priest. The priest offered it as a wave offering before God. And then God gave it to his servants, the priests. But here is the main difference with a peace offering. It ended with a carnivorous feast. What was distinctive about the fellowship offering was that it could be shared by the offerer, who would partake of the meal. As such, it is expressed as the joy of fellowship within a shared meal. A thanksgiving offering was to be eaten on the day that it was offered. You had a few days if you made a votive offering. That was if you had made a vow. But you could never take a doggy bag. You couldn't take this meat to go and journey back home. You had to enjoy it there at the sanctuary. It says in Deuteronomy chapter 12, before the Lord. And it was shared only with people who were ritually clean, that is, fit for worship. Let's read together Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 17 through 18. It says, you may not eat within your towns the tithe of your grain or of your wine or of your oil or the firstborn of your herd or of your flock or of any of your... I can't read it on there. I'm going to have to switch over to New American Standard. 12, verse 17. Firstborn of your herd or flock or any of your votive offerings which you vow or your freewill offerings, or the contribution of your hand. But you shall eat them before the Lord your God in the place which the Lord your God will choose. You and your sons and daughters, and your male and female servants, and the Levite who is within your gates. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God in all your undertakings. The other major difference was that peace offerings were voluntary. After making your guilt offering, your burnt offering, your drink offering, it says you were permitted, not required, to carry on to peace offerings. These sacrifices expressed a desire on the part of the offerer. And generally, they were not imposed by regulations. Now, there were a few times, if you had finished a Nazarite vow, you made a peace offering. During the Feast of Tabernacles, which I mentioned this morning is kind of the Hebrew Thanksgiving, they had some required peace offerings then. But did they have to do it? Most times, no. They didn't. That is what voluntary means. These were voluntary offerings. So what if no one ever did? What if a growing portion of Israelites came to worship and they made their atonement and they got all of the necessities covered? Got my sin offering, check. Here's your burnt offering, throw it on the fire, check. And now, done. You want to make a peace offering? No, I'm good. No fat for the fire. No portion to share with the altar. After all, the priest already got his cut of my sin offering. You've got to keep them humble. Nothing to take home with them from that occasion of worship. Just, thanks, I'm good. Imagine them standing outside the sanctuary with all the others who were there that day making the offering, and you're talking and having small talk, and one Jewish farmer says, "Oh, I'm having a great season. My son's bar mitzvah's coming up. We're going to have a big barbecue. I'm going to roast a whole goat. We'll probably do another one on grandma's birthday. You should come out." Well, got to get going. Lots to do. If all they wanted to do was what they had to do, would they have had peace? If they hadn't made a peace offering, would they have been at peace? They would have had atonement, but for what purpose? Would they really have at-one-ment with God? Would they be proving that the effect of that sacrifice was really shining forth in their hearts? Here in the last days, every kind of sacrifice that we're called to make is spiritual. And every one of those is a peace offering. Think about it. What does the peace offering come after? It comes after the sin has been atoned for. It comes after the burnt offering. Christ gave us atonement. He took away our sins. Everything that we do follows that. But there is enduring benefit to looking into the state of mind and the state of heart of Mosaic worshipers. What did our God want them to experience in the act of sacrifice? From first fruits, those offerings, we learn that God has always wanted our first. He's wanted our best. And the advantage of the initiative to be given up, to be given over to Him. There's nothing like that first fleece. And God says, "I desire that from you." Then there's the $100 sermon. From burnt offering, we feel the total dedication that God has always required from our service. There will be ways that we give and serve that shows no earthly benefit, that is good for nothing but maybe to make a point, that people may or may not notice, to leave an impression on another heart other than yours. A whole lot of Christian service is poured out and goes up in smoke just that way. We may never see what it does. But what is the major difference of a peace offering? Fellowship or peace offerings symbolize that you are in an intimate relationship with God. They did that because the worshipers shared a portion of that sacrifice. They gave to God, they gave to the priest, and then they went home, or they went out back to their family in the sanctuary area, and they enjoyed it together. Here's the thing about Christian fellowship. There are a few prescribed places where you could say Christian fellowship is required. But for the most part, when you look up koinonia, you can't boil down all the New Testament has to say about Christian fellowship into an itemized list of things you must do. Do you specifically have to do it? Let me ask you this. What if no one did make any special extra effort? What if we approached the offering of our fellowship in worship and in edification and in common living by faith by saying, just tell me what I have to do. So, somebody asks on the one hand, how much do I have to give? And you could answer, well, 2 Corinthians 9 says each one must give as he has decided in his heart. And a person with that mindset says, well, how much is that? I want to know so I can go to that limit and stop. And she asks, how much must I have to cover up? And you respond, well, you adorn yourself with respectable apparel, with modesty and with self-control, as 2 Timothy chapter 2 says. So, okay, well, what about yoga pants? She's looking for that line so she can go right to it. Or they ask, what about attendance? How much of that? And we could answer, well, you know, on the first day of the week, the disciples came together to break bread, Acts 20, verse 7. Do not neglect it, Hebrews 10, 25. They were day by day at the temple in Acts chapter 2. They were daily in the school of Tyrannus in Acts chapter 19. And they said, okay, all right, so that first one. Sunday worship, is that the official one? All right, we'll just do that one. Did the voluntary nature of peace offerings mean that Israel didn't have to do them? Or did it mean that they were the kind of thing that God shouldn't have to demand from a redeemed people? Exactly what of yourself did you surrender when you obeyed the gospel? Were they singing a song like I Surrender All on the day that you obeyed? When you sang that song this morning, did you have your own salvation in mind? Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 4 says, when you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for He has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Fellowship is the flavor of life. Fellowship within the church is like the fat that is thrown on the flames. It gives vibrancy to the burnt offering. A fellowship offering is the thing that you take to the sanctuary and you leave with the benefit that you immediately share with others who are likewise purified. It's not wrong. Not necessarily, and I've preached plenty of sermons that say it is, but technically it's not wrong to think about what you get out of worship. I got a lot out of that. You can say that. Or I didn't get anything out of that. You might feel that from time to time too. It's not wrong-headed, but here is the key to making it not wrong-headed. Here's the key to making it right when you're thinking, what do I get out of it? Here's the answer. What do you get out of it? It's your peace offering. So the question is, what did you bring? Was it unblemished by false motives? Did you take it all and did you give it all over to the Lord? Did you place it on top of your burnt offering? That is, did you first make a total, never going to get any of it back, dedication to the Lord? And finally, did you leave a choice portion for the work of the Lord? Did you go intending that there was something you were going to give to another? After considering all of those questions, here's my answer. Whatever you get out of it will be less than what you voluntarily brought. A person went and brought a peace offering. The fat was gone, the flank was gone, and a little bit was given back. It came back leaner, and it came back lighter. What you got out of it was what was done by the priesthood of believers to whatever you brought in the first place. But now it is dedicated. And now what you get out of services, you should consider doing the same thing that a person who got something out of sacrifice did. Use it among the faithful and use it quickly. Address it. We are blessed with an embarrassment of spiritual opportunity. Now, does that magnify Thanksgiving in your heart? Or is it like those rows and rows and rows of candy and steak every night? Does it dilute it? We have so much opportunity. We have so much spiritual knowledge. We have so much spiritual brotherhood. People overseas weep to see with what ease and what numbers we worship. There's a lot going on in the world around us, crowding in for our attention, calling for our participation, and a lot of them are good. Because we're busy, it means we got jobs to do, it means we got homes to maintain, it means we've got cars to go around in, and health care that prolongs us, and children that we mold and educate and socialize. But let me ask you, are any of those things blessings if they don't motivate us to enjoy them specifically through the act of engaging in fellowship? Don't we need to take all of the things that we enjoy and process them through our experience with God? If they keep us from fellowship, they're not blessings. They're burdens. They're what the parable of the sower characterizes as thorns. Where does the spirit of the peace offering live on with us today? In the Christian who says, "Man, I'm blessed." And then he takes whatever motivated him to say that and he runs it through his experience with the church's fellowship. Those blessings don't come through that prioritization without being changed. Like the lamb or the calf or the goat at the sanctuary, they come out leaner and they come out lighter. You've weighed them on the scales and said, "Okay, well, I don't need this." Prioritizing for fellowship requires you to cut the fat and burn it. Hold that ball schedule, that work schedule, that school schedule, that vacation schedule up against the church schedule and the church goals. And then you harmonize them and you give the priority to the spiritual things and to the spiritual people. Why do we share birthdays, anniversaries, graduations, weddings, births, baptisms? Whether we do it in our bulletins or on bulletin boards or by email, by word of mouth among each other, why do we talk about these things in the brotherhood? Because those are the sorts of occasions where an Israelite might say, "Let's go to the sanctuary and let's make this celebration special with some fellowship." Voluntary sacrifices expressed a desire on the part of the offerer. Are you not a Christian, but you desire peace? That's offered freely by the Lord at this very moment. Here is water. And the benefit to you even more is, here are saints. Here is your future family, ready to catch your newborn body and receive you and process you in all great joy and fellowship. And Christian, having peace, don't you desire to celebrate it with free will offerings? You do that in fellowship with your brethren. And it doesn't just have to be for celebration. The Lord has given us to each other for healing. The Lord stands ready, seated on His throne, to forgive. But he says, you got to repent. He's given us each other for that. And so we stand as his hands and his arms to receive you. If you need to be born again, if you need to be reprioritized and make your fellowship offering of repentance tonight, come forward while we stand and sing.